The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth on Impeachment-Free Tuesday. We're going 3 hours without talking about impeachment at all. And we are joined now by my good friend and partner in Steve Hayward. Steve, thanks for being on the program.
Hi, John. Good to be here. Don't mind my cough. I'm getting over some bronchitis.
Well, just have some cough drops handy, and we'll bear with it. So, Steve, I just during the break read the post you did earlier on Powerline on Kamala Harris exiting the Democratic presidential nomination field, and I thought it would be fun to spend some time today talking about how that race is shaping up and what's happening and what's not happening. One of the funny things in your post is you put up a screenshot of a prediction or a handicap that was done by alleged experts, Chris Saliza. Who's he with now? Is it still the Washington Post?
I don't remember. It's a political or one of those. I mean, he's
He bounces around, but one of these Washington insiders, Chris Saliza, and Harry Enten. Their definitive 2020 Democratic candidate power rankings. Number one on their list, Kamala Harris. Well, they were not alone. I actually thought she might have the best shot. Number two on their list, Beto O'Rourke, right? So, that didn't pan out well. So, Steve, right. what do you have to say?
Well, a lot of things. Look, everyone thought, including a lot of Republicans and conservative observers, that Kamala Harris was the female Barack Obama. She's young, attractive, now senator from a big state, California, right? And then, of course, there's this hunger in the Democratic Party for a woman candidate since Hillary went down in flames. And she was raising a lot of money early on and lots of buzz about her. And, you know, I noticed that right out of the box, way back last spring, she stumbled badly on a whole bunch of issues where, first she's for Medicare for all, then the next day, well, maybe not really, because that would have, it was clear she was not ready for prime time. And that she hadn't really thought through both specific issues, hadn't thought through a general strategy for her campaign and what her candidacy would be about. And unlike Obama, I mean, say what you will about Obama's limited experience in 2008 and his ideology, he did hire a first-rate campaign team and ran a focused campaign to get the nomination. Kamala Harris hired her sister to be campaign chairman. The New York Times detailed all these mistakes in an article a few days ago that was kind of the death blow to her campaign, I think, when the Times dumped all over. Anyway, I'm not surprised that she sank like a stone because she clearly hadn't thought this through. And I'm talking on too long here, but it's not unusual for people who have a national reputation and a lot of buzz around them to flame out when they go from the state level to running for president, which is an order of magnitude more difficult than running for governor. It's even harder than running for governor of all 50 states. I think on the Republican side, Scott Walker found that out in 2016. I was initially very enthusiastic about Walker. He raised a lot of money, and it was clear early on in the campaign that he hadn't thought through exactly what he was doing and how to go about it. And boy, he was out early, unfortunately. Because
Steve, it's really amazing. You made that point in your Powerline post. I made exactly the same analogy earlier on the radio before I'd read your post, that this reminds me of how Scott Walker started out as seeming to be one of the front runners, raised a bunch of money, ran through his money, and was out of the race before a single vote had been cast. I think it's
right.
Let's stay with Kamala Harris and then talk about some of the other candidates. When you talk about, she's not a stupid person. I think she's relatively able compared to a lot of these folks. So why was she just so far off base? Do you think part of the answer might be that it goes back to identity politics, that the Democrats are so fixated on identity politics that I'm not sure she ever really got past the idea of, I'm black, I'm a woman, I'm less than 70 years old. I got the nomination.
Right, right. And you know, everyone wants another a female Obama is what everybody wants. If you think about her out in California for a minute, though, she never really ran a hard campaign against a Republican or even other Democrats. You know, she was district attorney of San Francisco, which is kind of a layup, with a lot of help from Willie Brown, as we know. And then she runs for the U.S. Senate, well, for the Attorney General of California. And once again, in this heavily Democratic state, it was an easy race for her. And then running for the U.S. Senate, the same thing happened. You had two Democrats on the ballot. She didn't even run against the Republican in the November election when she first ran, well, I think 4 years ago now, whatever it was. And so she's never really been tested in a serious way. And, you know, Obama, he lost a few races. Again, to make that comparison, he'd been through the rough and tumble of running for the state legislature. And then although he had an easy Senate race in 2004, you know, he actually had experience losing. And I think it's always good for people to lose when they run for office. So, I think she just presumed way too much. But it's really, to move on from that, I just think the way the whole Democratic field has shaking apart, you know, the other identity politics candidate, well, there's more than one that the whole field is, really. But it's Elizabeth Warren, who I thought a month or 6 weeks ago was likely to win the nomination. And now she's sinking like a stone.
And it's ironic. Like, and Steve, it's ironic, too, because she's the only woman of color left in the race.
No, that's right. One, you made me cough, John. One 1,024th woman of color, according to the DNA test, right? Yeah. But look, I mean, she's thinking like a stone because her Medicare for All plan is completely lunatic. And I also know from talking to people in Silicon Valley, I know that her talk about really ridiculous confiscatory wealth taxes is scaring the heck out of a lot of rich Democrats who say, look, I'm a progressive, I'm a Democrat, but I'm not into a suicide pact, you know, for myself or for the country. So she has made all kinds of blunders because, once again, she's running to be the president of Cambridge, Massachusetts, more than the president of the United States.
Well, there have even been rumblings out of Wall Street that if she gets the nomination, Wall Street's going to get behind Donald Trump. Now, it's almost impossible to imagine Wall Street supporting a Republican, but given her radical views, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, the way the Democratic field is going, they're going to make George McGovern look like a Republican middle-class Rotarian before they're done.
So, Steve, let me just try this idea out on you. If I were a Democrat, I would be petrified with anxiety every time I looked at a poll and saw Joe Biden continuing to lead the pack. I mean, this guy is a walking disaster. He can't get through a public appearance without winding up, on YouTube making a fool of himself. I mean, this is like watching a slow motion train wreck.
Oh, you know, it's quite obvious that he has passed his prime. He always had a problem.
His prime was none
right?
too good, by the way, either.
Oh, no, he's always had that sort of, you know, a diarrhea of the mouth and said goofy things, but at least he was vigorous and alert and talked about issues in a semi-coherent way. And now, even when he has a good point to make, he mangles it. I'd be terrified of that, too. I mean, I think I can remember now it was 40 years ago. Well, 40 years ago last month, Ronald Reagan declared for president at the age of 68. People thought, oh, he's too old. But you know, you talk to reporters that actually read the accounts at the time about how vigorous Reagan was on the campaign trail. He'd be on the campaign trail in New Hampshire from 8 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and the reporters were worn out. Well, I don't think Joe Biden is giving anybody that impression at the age of 78 or whatever he is. 10 years older than Reagan when Reagan ran.
And Steve, he's also deeply weird. I mean, this man needs to stop talking about his experiences in municipal swimming pools.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, you know, whether it's going on about the hair on his legs and the children, or whether it's, you know, biting his wife's finger. I mean, the man is just completely bizarre.
Well, you know, I think the Trump campaign strategy all along is going to be just going to play commercials of Democrats talking, and then ban the networks not to air it.
So we haven't talked about Bernie Sanders. You know, Bernie, if the DNC had not had its fingers on the scale 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders likely would have won the nomination. How about Bernie?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've always thought that case was slightly overstated for this reason. 4 years ago, the Democrats still had their huge super delegates, the party officials who get a vote in the convention. And, they instituted that back in the 80s when they didn't want first under Jimmy Carter and when they didn't want Jesse Jackson to win the nomination in 88. But because of the upset over the way Bernie was treated 4 years ago, they have demoted the superdelegates, who now won't have a vote until a second ballot. And so Bernie, he did well last time, but I think that's what's attracted so many other Democrats to move to the left in this field, and so now it's crowded. The progressive lane is a traffic jam, if you might.
Yeah, the left-wing lane is crowded, and Bernie, in the meantime, has had a heart attack. Steve, we got to run to a break. Can you stay with us for another segment?
Sure.
We'll be right back with Steve Hayward after this. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. We are talking with Steve Hayward. Steve, one thing about this show is that it has the best bumper music in radio. I mean, not everyone remembers Charlie Pride.
Well, I know you're a country fan, so I will defer to your expertise on that.
So we've been talking about the landscape with respect to the Democratic presidential nomination in the wake of Kamala Harris's withdrawal from the campaign. We were talking about Bernie Sanders before the break, Steve, and I don't think we need to say much more about him, but it just seems to me that as happens in politics, his moment has passed. And of course, he's 4 years older now than he was then. And he still polls rather well. And there's some dedicated Bernie bros out there, but I just don't see him as the nominee. Do you?
No, not at all. He has a pretty hard ceiling of probably no more than 20% of the Democratic Party primary electorate that's very left. The Democratic Party electorate, it really does have three factions, or maybe more than three, but the three main ones are the hardcore progressive left, who are really only about a quarter of Democratic voters. Then you have minorities, black voters, who are still, for the time being, loyal to Biden, who, although liberal and very loyal to the Democratic Party, aren't necessarily deep-dish, far-left people, except in places like Oakland and, in Baltimore and a few places like that. And then finally, you have sort of moderate liberals in the Democratic Party. And, they're not very excited by anybody right now because the whole field has moved pretty far to the left.
So who else are serious contenders? I mean, one thing that just amazes me, Steve, is that Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is taken seriously as a presidential contender. He's been rising in the polls. There's been a lot of buzz. My reaction is, are you kidding me? Pete Buttigieg, seriously?
Well, look, I'll say two things. Well, I can say a lot of things about it. First of all, he's raised a ton of money. We'll come back to that in a minute. He's raised the most money of anybody in the field, which is quite amazing. He's obviously very bright and handles himself very well out on the stump. And I think he thought about this. And I think he'd give Trump some fits in some ways. However, here's the interesting part. Where does most of his money come from? I think it comes from a lot of rich gay activists in the Democratic Party who are very affluent. And they're excited about the first credible, quote-unquote, credible gay candidate for president. So that makes some sense. Now, on the other hand, I keep reading these stories in the media, and they really crack me up about why Buttigieg is not attracting any black voters who are essential to winning the nomination and the general election for Democrats. And look, let's be plain about this. And I wrote about this on Powerline. Black voters are not fond of homosexuality, full stop. If you go back to 2008 out here in California, when gay marriage was on the ballot on a statewide initiative, it was black voters who voted most overwhelmingly against gay marriage, a subject of great embarrassment to the left. Apparently, black voters in California didn't get the memo about intersectionality, about the same matrix of oppression. And all the news stories about why is Buttigieg not getting traction with black voters, they talk about, he has problems in this town of South Bend. And they mention the fact that homosexuality is not popular with black voters in one sentence, and then drop the subject as fast as they possibly can because they don't want to talk about this. But I think if Buttigieg were the nominee, I think Trump wins 20% of the black vote or more. And Trump
I think more.
He
may win 20% anyway. But
he might. He's showing some polling strength. But black voters, even though black voters often say they're sympathetic to Republicans, they're such loyal Democratic voters, it's hard to crack that. But Trump might be the one person who can do it.
So staying with identity politics for a moment, Steve, is there any possibility that the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, if he were a heterosexual, would be a serious contender for the presidency?
I think he'd be a serious contender for the Democratic nomination, because the Democrats tend to like new faces, young and dynamic. That's why Gary Hart surged in 1984. That's why McGovern came out of nowhere in 1972.
Oh, Jimmy Carter, Obama, Bill Clinton, Obama. You can go on and on. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the fact that you've got all these old geezers, Bernie Sanders and Biden, and even Elizabeth Warren to some extent, who's 70 now, I think, or about to be. That's a little bit of an anomaly for Democrats, except Warren's kind of a new face, so that makes some sense. It's always Republicans who go for the old established person. And
Bob Dole.
Parties who kind of change places. Bob Dole, exactly. You know, Ronald Reagan, even. I think it's not inconceivable he could get the nomination, because he is running a well-organized campaign. He's running into some trouble. They're starting to take shots at him. I think the other person who I think would be a strong candidate, except I don't think he can get the nomination, and that's Michael Bloomberg.
Mini Mike, as President Trump has already dubbed him, Mini Mike.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
See, this is another example of a guy, and maybe my imagination is too constricted, but this is another guy I find it hard to take seriously as a presidential candidate. Number one, he's part of the geriatric brigade. How old is he? 70,
77,
something.
I think.
77.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an old man,
Yeah.
And number two, he's a former Republican. And I don't see Democratic primary voters yearning to nominate a former Republican for president. Number three, he's worth like $54 billion. Dollars, and he comes across like it. I mean, Donald Trump may be a billionaire, but he doesn't act like one. I mean, to me, Mike Bloomberg, you take one look at him, you say, wow, that guy's worth billions. And again, I don't see it. Number four, and I say this as a rather short person myself, right? But Bloomberg is like, what, 5'3 or 5'4? I mean, picture Michael Bloomberg on the stage next to Donald Trump. I mean, he is not a guy that the masses are going to say, oh, he's our man, and run out and vote for him, are they?
I don't think so. I mean, I think he can't get the Democratic nomination, not just because he's a former Republican, but because he's a billionaire, right? He's worth 10 times as much Trump is. And billionaires are the most unpopular people in the Democratic Party right now. And so the progressive base of the Democrat and black voters won't like him. But, by the way, I think he was not a half bad mayor of New York. A lot of things that drove me out of my mind. He's a deep dish climatista. He's a gun grabber. He wants to ban 20-ounce sodas. He just wants to do lots of stupid things. But on the nuts and bolts of running New York, he wasn't half bad. He's way better than de Blasio they have him now. So he has a credible record to talk about, but he's not going to do that. He's going to screw it all up, and I just don't see him getting any traction. The fun part, remember, Hillary Clinton complained about Donald Trump standing behind her in the debate.
Right.
What Trump will do is walk in front of Bloomberg and he'll disappear like the moon does in the eclipse.
Hey, Steve, I don't want to impose on your time, but can you stay with us for one more segment?
Sure, happy to.
All right, terrific. We'll be back after these messages with Steve Hayward. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm John Hinderacher, filling in for Seth today, and we are talking with Steve Hayward, one of my partners at Powerline, reviewing the lineup of the Democratic presidential candidates who are still standing after Kamala Harris's withdrawal from the race. And Steve, the more we talk about the Democratic candidates, the better I feel about President Trump's reelection chances next year.
For all of the Trump's defects and problems and abrasiveness, he gets to run against the Democrats. Yeah, the Democrats seem heck-bent on delivering a completely unelectable candidate who's going to drive a lot of undecided and moderate voters and swing voters back into Trump's arms.
So there are several candidates that we haven't talked about and probably don't need to. I don't know. But I want to just spend a moment on my hometown candidate, Amy Klobuchar. Amy has been very formidable as a politician here in Minnesota, where I live. And she has some things going for her. One, she's a woman. Two, she's relatively young. She's I'm not sure how old she is, but she's not 70, you know. And she's intelligent. And she is like a lot of Minnesota Democrats. She is good at sounding moderate. You know, she may advocate extreme policies, but she does it in a moderate kind of way. And over the years, she's actually gotten a considerable amount of support from the Twin Cities business community. So when she entered the race, I thought she might be a candidate to watch. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think if she could win the nomination, she would be a very formidable challenge to Trump, because she's kind of the anti-Trump. She, like you say, she embodies what you guys there in Minnesota call Minnesota Nice, right? Even though she is very left. I think she's been very shrewd in not trying to outcompete with Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren to be the craziest Bernie Sanders-type candidate on the stage. But the problem is the Democratic base wants that very badly. They want red meat. They want somebody who's just as angry or, you know, as outrageous as Trump, and or at least, you know, the part of the base that makes most noise on Twitter and elsewhere. And so who knows? I mean, her strategy may be, I mean, look, she's still in the race. She hasn't dropped out like Harris. Who knows if she's raising money. But, you know, it's possible that if she did well in Iowa, which is only now, you know, 6 weeks away or whatever it is, she does well in Iowa and turns in a good showing, you know, in the first couple primaries, and the field will thin fast, she might yet emerge as a strong contender. I, you know, Biden, as we said earlier, he just seems old and doddering, and I think it'd be a disaster if he wins. But I think Klobuchar, of the field that exists now, is maybe their strongest candidate against Trump on paper.
You know, I have a relative, an in-law of one of my brothers, who is a dedicated Democrat and was all in for Hillary Clinton. And she literally moved from New York City to New Hampshire so that she can work on behalf of Amy Klobuchar in New Hampshire. I don't know how many fans that dedicated Amy has, but she's got at least one anyway. Of the people we haven't talked about, Steve, is there anybody else? Are there any sleepers, you know, in the group that might surprise?
Well, I mean, there's two things. One is, Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts. I'm told by fairly reliable sources that he got into the race, just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, partly at the behest of party insiders who were alarmed at the the weakness of the field and the radicalism of the field. Now, he's a very liberal guy, but, you know, he was a state governor, and they usually make strong candidates. We'll see if he actually amasses some money and does anything. And then the other thing is, I don't know, I keep thinking that Hillary Clinton is sharpening her sword off in Chappaqua, New York, hoping for a Democratic convention. I know, but look, I mean, the Clintons are irrepressible, right? Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself. I think we're supposed to say that at some point, right? And all these conversations involving Hillary. Stranger things have happened these days. I mean, who would have thought 5 years ago that Donald Trump would be the colossus he's turned out to be? And so I think that so many things have changed in the last few years that you don't want to count something like that out.
Last question. We got about 50 seconds, Steve. Last question. Can any of these folks beat Donald Trump?
Not right now. Not without some exogenous shock, as economists say. Without some blunder by Trump, an economic catastrophe of some kind in the next 8 or 9 months. Without a foreign war or foreign crisis that he handles badly. I think right now Trump has the high hand. If the election were today, I think Trump would win against almost anyone in the field and win easily.
Four more years, man. Four more years. Steve Hayward, thank you for being with us on the Seth Leibson Show. We'll be back after these messages. Well, it's been a party today here on the Seth Leibson Show. Thank you for being with us. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth today. I filled in yesterday as well, and I'll be back tomorrow and also on Friday while Seth is frolicking in the Holy Land with Dennis Prager, a place I would like to be right now as I look out the windows at the frozen tundra of Minnesota, where we are buried under unseasonably early snowstorms. So yesterday, the whole show almost got taken up with impeachment. Well, it was in the news. The Wednesday hearing had been set, all that kind of thing. So we kind of had to do it. But today I promised our listeners an impeachment-free Tuesday, and I'm proud to say I've delivered on that pledge. We've covered a number of topics, both foreign and domestic, but have barely mentioned the I word, and we only have a couple of short segments left to go, and I promise you it will not feature in the remaining conversation. What I'd really like to do here is take a couple of calls, so if you want to weigh in on anything we've been talking about today or something brand new, just give us a call. The number is 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Well, what to talk about in these last segments of the show? I've got a couple of kind of major news stories, major topics that I think I'm just going to hold for tomorrow because we don't have enough time to do them justice, but maybe one or two that are a little more eccentric. This is a very strange story that's come out of England. And it ties in with the NATO conference that's going on in London. And this is a headline. This is an actual headline from yesterday's Sun newspaper. And if you're not familiar with the British press, the Sun is the number one selling newspaper in the United Kingdom. I think it's owned by Murdoch, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, it's the Sun newspaper, and it's a tabloid. About 98% of what it does is like celebrities on vacation in bikinis, bizarre crime, things of that sort. Soccer, a lot of soccer coverage. And maybe 2% is actually news. But this is a headline from The Sun. Leaked National Health Service papers used by Jeremy Corbyn to smear the Tories linked to Kremlin fake news campaign. So once again, we have Russia-generated fake news in the headline. And these are papers that were leaked from Britain's National Health Service, their socialized medicine service, which is awful. And Jeremy Corbyn got these leaked papers and used them to smear the Tories. As you probably know, they've got an election going on right now in which the Conservative Party has got, I think, currently about a 9-point lead in the polls over Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn, as you probably know, is a hardline left-winger who still yearns for the days of the Soviet Union and would like to recreate that wonderful experiment of socialism, which somehow keeps failing time after time in Great Britain. I don't think he's going to have the opportunity. So anyway, what's the story all about? Here's the story from Sun. Leaked papers used by Jeremy Corbyn to smear the Tories were last night linked to a Kremlin fake news campaign. The dossier, there's that word again, dossier. And I think all of us, anytime we hear the word dossier, our antenna go up like, oh my gosh, you know, it's probably nothing but lies. That appears to be true again here. The dossier said to show that Boris Johnson, the current prime minister, would sell the National Health Service to Donald Trump was ripped off the online forum Reddit. And it continues, but analysts say the papers waved by Mr. Corbyn at an election rally bore the hallmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign called Secondary Infection. Ben Nimmo, head of investigations at the media analytics outfit Graphica, said, quote, "It's on the same set of websites. It's using the same types of accounts and making the same language errors." Yeah, like when you translate from Russian to English. it's either the Russian operation or someone trying hard to look like it. The original Reddit posting, the Sun says, was uploaded on October 21, but was little known until Mr. Corbyn unveiled it at a highly publicized campaign event on Wednesday. The Labour Party, which Corbyn heads, is not buying the theory that this is a Russian disinformation campaign about a plot to sell the National Health Service to Donald Trump. Again, back to the article in the Sun newspaper. A Labour spokesman said, quote, "These documents reveal the plot against our National Health Service. And, of course, neither the UK nor the US government have denied their authenticity." Well, not yet, I guess, at least as of the time they went to press. And so I was reading this story in the Sun, but what I was trying to get past, wrap my head around is, what does it mean to say that a plot has been uncovered by Boris Johnson and the Tories to sell the National Health Service to Donald Trump? It's a little hard to understand how exactly that would be carried out. However, now we're going to go to a little bit more reputable news source. I'm not saying more accurate or any better, but it's the difference between, the New York Post and the New York Times, say. We're now going to the London Times. They also are reporting on this story, and their report picks up with Donald Trump arriving in London for the NATO conference that's going on right now. And the first line of their story, this is how their story actually begins. They can't write anything about President Trump without, in some fashion, attacking him. And here's the first line of their story. Donald Trump has insisted he wants, quote, "nothing to do with," close quote, "the National Health Service, despite saying he wanted to stay out of the UK election during his visit to the UK." So they view this as going back on his pledge to stay out of the UK election. So what happened was that he was asked by a reporter about this story that he was plotting to buy the National Health Service, and he responded, "I wouldn't take the National Health Service on a silver platter. I wouldn't take it if they offered to give it to me." Which leaves open the question of what on earth would it mean for the United States of America to buy Britain's National Health Service? We'll have a possible answer to that conundrum when we return for one last segment here on The Seth Leibson Show. When Seth returns from Israel, I am definitely going to compliment him on his choice of bumper music. It is great stuff, that last song, one of my favorites by Keith Urban. So this is the last segment of the show. Again, I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth today. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. And before the break, we were talking about what I would nominate as the day's most bizarre news story. And it is this report out of Great Britain, this claim by Jeremy Corbyn, the head of the Labour Party, who's running for prime minister right now, that Donald Trump is plotting with the Tories to buy the National Health Service, Britain's socialized medicine system, from the UK. Now, I don't really understand how that would work or why anybody would even imagine such a thing. But let's pick up. This is a report from the London Times, which apparently is taking this whole thing rather seriously. This is the London Times. In a series of interviews earlier today, Jeremy Corbyn said he was planning to challenge the U.S. president over the health service at a Buckingham Palace reception this evening. He said he would tell Mr. Trump, quote, "Welcome to this country. I hope you'll understand how precious our National Health Service is. And in any future trade relationship with the USA, none of our public services are on the table. None of our public services are for sale, and investor state protection is not acceptable to our government when we, that is labor, have won this election. Now, according to news reports, this is based on this claim that Trump is plotting to buy the National Health Service somehow, is based on so-called leaked documents, which reportedly are based on some Russian fake news, some Russian disinformation. And this is an actual legitimate news story from the London Times. So when President Trump landed in London and he gave that hour-long press conference, just a virtuoso performance, answering questions from all comers, this is now where the London Times story picks up. In his first press appearance of a three-day visit, however, Mr. Trump disavowed any interest in the NHS. Quote, "We have absolutely nothing to do with it, and we wouldn't want to if you handed it to us on a silver platter. We want nothing to do with it." Close quote. That's Donald Trump putting to rest this the so-called dossier about wanting to buy the National Health Service. The fact is, nobody wants to buy the National Health Service. No one wants to take it for free. It's socialized medicine. It's terrible. And the Democratic presidential candidates should keep that in mind, the desperate condition of Britain's National Health Service, when they time after time advocate socializing our health care system here in the U.S. That's going to do it for today. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, and I will be back with you tomorrow.